history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that we ought to hear. We don't want them to go untold, and we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Hanford, California, with 97-year-old Russell Brookshire. When he was in the Army Air Corps, some of his buddies called him Scooter, but if you grew up around Hanford, you probably called him Doctor. Maybe he even delivered you. But we're going to go way back before he ever heard of Hanford, California, to his childhood in Burke Burnett, Texas. You want to tell everybody where Burke Burnett, Texas is and how big that place is?
Burke Burnett is about 90 miles northwest of Fort Worth. Population at the time I lived there was slightly under 3,000 souls. Most of the population was employed the surrounding oil fields and farming.
And you had an older brother?
Had an older brother, 2 years older than I.
So what was that childhood like there? I mean, I've been to that part of the country in August. I know you sweat a lot in the summer and it's very humid, but what was that childhood like in Burke Burnett?
I lived in a happy family home, 2 blocks from Main Street. My father was an oil field worker. My mother, during the Depression years, had gone to cosmetology school and became a hairdresser and added to the meager earnings of Dad as an oil field worker.
So you could see, even as a young boy, the effects of the Great Depression? You felt some of that?
No, not really, because Mom and Dad stretched their meager earnings, and we had everything that we needed to live. Dad purchased a home that became our family home in town for $1,200. It was home for all my childhood. Prior to that, we lived on a company lease, oil lease, 3 miles from town. It was a company owned and all utilities and rent free. When Dad bought the house, moved into town, it was like a castle to us.
Do you remember in those early years, your school years, having some ideas of what you were going to do someday, what you were going to be when you grew up, or the adventures you might have?
I had dreams of flying. I oftentimes, in the summertime, lay in the grass in the backyard with a friend of mine who later became a pilot also. We'd watch the occasional airplane fly over, and just in our imagination, we envisioned ourselves doing the same up in the air.
What was your first chance to get up in the air? Do you remember your first experience in a plane?
Yes. After graduation in 1940, enrolled in a junior college at Cameron State College in Oklahoma, and enrolled my second year in a government program called CPT, which is Civilian Pilot Training, and flew my first time in the air in that course. And the desire for more knowledge in aviation was inborn from that time.
Do you still remember that feeling? The first time you got in the air, what that felt like, especially when you got to be at the controls?
I never have thought of it. I just wanted more and more.
And what was that? Would that have been a Stearman or a Piper Cub? Or?
It was a two-seated side-by-side Taylor craft, a 65-horse motor.
So I don't want to miss anything either. Your high school days in Burke Burnett, were you playing any sports or anything? I saw a tall, handsome man there.
I ran track. Played a little baseball, did make the team, and played some tennis on the team.
And when you went off to Cameron and you started doing that pilot training and everything, did you have any idea that there was a hint or a possibility of war coming to the U.S.?
Yes. In fact, war was on the horizon, and Britain had been fighting World War II beginning in 1939. The United States, under the Lend-Lease Act, was furnishing munitions and airplanes to Great Britain and the Allies, Russia also, and continued supplying munitions under the Lease-Lend Act. still, the United States was not in the war. They were just a supplier of wartime equipment. Probably, at that time at least, the United States would not have entered the war until December 41, and the Japanese pushed the United States to declare war against the Japanese and Nazi Germany.
Do you remember where you were and how you found out about that, December 7th, 41?
Absolutely. As a college student, I had a part-time job as an usher in one of the theaters in Lawton, Oklahoma, frequented mostly by the soldiers at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. The theater was down in that part of town and ran a lot of the naughty-type movies. I was working, I don't know what time it was in Hawaii, but that was early afternoon in Lawton, and I heard on the radio that the United States had been attacked at Pearl Harbor.
What kind of feelings did that produce in you? Was that a shock? Did it make you angry? Did you think you were going to do something about it? How did you handle that?
I felt very, very strongly about it and decided to join the Air Corps. Probably at that time, the lines became so long at the recruiting station. All the young people wanted a piece of that and kill the Japanese. The feeling was very, very strong, and the whole country was just carried away and making preparations and doing all they could to create a fighting force.
But something else was going on at this time there in Lawton, Oklahoma, because you'd met a special someone there at Cameron?
Yes. I met this little girl from Walters, Oklahoma. Her name was Pensy Ruth Barbie. Prettiest little girl I'd ever seen, and as sweet as she could be. I had desires to acquaint myself with her, and at the time, she was a year behind me in college. Her boyfriend was Sanders Cox. He was a middleweight fighter and rose to some degree of national recognition in the middleweight division later on. But he was Pensy Ruth's boyfriend at the time. He was, at this particular time, he was out on an athletic tour among Oklahoma schools and boxing team. And I thought sure that he was going to pound me into the ground when he came home. But that didn't occur. He thought probably, well, there's more sand on the beach. And so actually, Sanders and I became friends, and for several months we were roommates in the dormitory. I met her. She was the only one in my life from then on.
And I talked to so many veterans who had that dilemma. Should I try to get married before I go overseas in the service, or take the chance that we're both still feeling the same if I come back? Did you guys talk about that at all?
You know, that probably crossed my mind, but it didn't deter me nor her. I was destined to be in the service, and if I did not come back, let's hurry up and get married. Well, we didn't get married for almost three more years after I graduated from flight school. I graduated 5th of January in 43, and we got married on the 20th of February, 44.
Again, I'm thinking about so many other guys I've talked to. Just about everyone I've met who was in the Army Air Corps got in because he wanted to be a pilot. But that actually became reality for very few of the people who enlisted in the Army Air Corps. So you joined in April 42. You had your sights set on being a pilot. Were there some challenges along the way where you saw other guys washed out, or maybe that could have been you, that you had to overcome to become a pilot?
You know, I took to flying like a hog goes for slop. I was in Wonderland. I excelled in everything that I did in the Air Corps, and was rewarded accordingly as time went on, with being selected for a number of activities that are above and beyond the rest of the group.
What were some of the places that they sent you along the way before you got your wings?
Well, due to my previous flight experience in the CPT, when I joined the Air Corps, I had approximately 150 hours in the air. And due to that previous flying experience, I was selected under the Lend-Lease Act that Great Britain had moved all of their primary flight trainees to the United States because of the air over Britain was so dangerous from the Luftwaffe knocking the student pilots out of the air. So all of the IAF was trainees were here in the United States. I was selected to be in a ratio of 17 per 100 RAF cadets in every class. So I was trained in the RAF base that was had been established at Miami, Oklahoma. And instead of the U.S. programs of primary move to secondary move to advanced types of aircraft, the RAF had shortened those periods. We had the primaries and the Fairchild PT-19 aircraft. From there, stayed at the same base, but went to the advanced aircraft. North American AT-6s were retractable gear, much, much more powerful than the primary. Went all the way through the remainder of the training period in the AT-6. Then the AT-6 graduates primarily were to go to fighter school, single-engine fighter school. I was looking forward to that and wound up being assigned to a four-engine bomber school at Great Falls, Montana. So I flew four engines the rest of my days.
Was that a disappointment to you at the time?
At the time it was.
But now you have a little different perspective?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I had a different idea. I could get up and go wee-wee, and you couldn't do that in a single engine. Get up and I learned to love the four engine. At that time, we were designated to go to England to the 8th Air Force. I had slightly over 100 hours flying time in the B-17, and the mission was changed. Instead of going to the 8th Air Force in England, I went to the CBI Theater at B-24s. Well, 17s and the 24s. It's like Ford and Chevrolet. Some people liked one and more or less spit on the other, but I loved the old 24 because it brought me home so many times.
Yeah, 78 missions. And you said it's CBI, China, Burma, India. And, you know, so often this is a forgotten part of World War II because we hear so much about Europe and the landings and the air war there and the naval battles and all the amphibious landings in the Pacific. But there's a huge amount of territory in China, Burma, and India, and some of the most dangerous situations that Americans faced, some of them even before America was actually in the war, when you go back to General Chenault and his Flying Tigers and all of that. How often do you run into people who have a puzzled look when you tell them where you served in World War II?
Some of them don't have any knowledge at all of that part of the world during the war.
So I'm sure you set them straight, right? You help them understand why it was significant?
Tried.
Well, here's your opportunity now. But I'm interested. Well, I guess I should ask first, when did you head overseas?
In September of 44.
So you got married right before that?
Mm-hmm. In February.
So you're married, and now you're heading overseas. Do you think you're going to see your wife again, or are you sure about that?
You know, I didn't think on that side of the equation at all. I'm going over and whip those Japanese, not having any idea of the task, really.
Well, I'm sure you're going to help us understand the task. I've talked to some guys who, you know, maybe it was a wife, it was a girlfriend, but some of them would carry that little photo in their pocket of their uniform, or they'd put it somewhere up on the, you know, in the cockpit. Did you have some way of keeping her in mind while you're over there?
I did not have a photo of her in the cockpit. Many, many times during a mission, I wondered if I would ever see her again.
Well, I want to hear about some of those, but let's talk about where they sent you and how you got there. From the U.S., it's a long way to that part of the world.
We embarked from Florida down across the Caribbean to Trinidad and over to Natal, Brazil. From Natal, we hopped over to Ascension Island, to Africa, and across Africa to India. It took us about 2 weeks from the U.S.
So you actually flew a B-24?
I was a co-pilot in a B-24.
But that's how you got there?
Yeah.
Because some guys would have been taken by ship or some crews taken another way.
Yeah.
And did you have the crew that you were going to be flying your missions with?
No.
Not yet.
As I say, I was a co-pilot on that trip. From Natal to Ascension Island was about 8 hours flight time. as we got close to the Ascension Island, it was the only land in the whole South Atlantic. If we missed that, we were swimming a long way. But I remember as we were approaching the end of our fuel endurance, thinking back, we had low-frequency radios that we had 50, 60-mile range. What if we miss that little island? Well, we're going to get wet. And one of the crew members voiced that concern. He was quite a religious young man and had his Bible in hand, and he handed it up to me, and he says, Lieutenant, if we miss Ascension, you want to read this? You want to read the Bible? I said, no. When we get to our ETA, estimated time of arrival, when we get to ETA, hand it back to me. I'll read it then. But we've made the contact with Ascension, and it was an RAF base. We refueled and stayed there for 2 to 3 days for mechanical something, and went on to Dakar in Africa.
And then on to India from there?
Yeah, all across Africa to Karachi, and Karachi to the far northeast corner of India, Jorhat, which now is a huge city.
What'd you find when you got there in 1944?
It was a strip, a runway, a little over 3,000 feet, hacked out of the jungle, just one way in, one direction.
Regardless of what the wind's doing.
Didn't make any difference what the wind's doing. You got to be on one end of the strip or the other to take off.
And that's where you would fly all your missions from there?
All of them.
Uh-huh, all 78. Were you nervous at all before the first one?
I was anxious and wondered what we would find. I don't remember that first one. I was co-pilot for the first 6 or 8, and then went through B-24 training, and then I was a head dog in the aircraft from then on.
How much did you know the guys in your crew?
Intimately, with the regular crew members. And I gained confidence in their ability to do their assigned position, and they grew to trust me at the controls. They'd go through hell with me, and did.
It's break time, but you can bet we're going to find out what he means by that when we come back. In the meantime, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook for photos of Dr. Russell Brookshire then and now. There's a Christmas story coming that I don't think you've ever heard before. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.